The Red Eye Radio Podcast is a service of Freightliner and Detroit.
Now, it's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or you're just starting your day, welcome to the show. This is Red Eye Radio.
All across America, 866-90-RED-EYE. He is Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara. Good morning. A couple of stories here, then some of your calls and comments. This story intrigued me. The Transportation Security Administration confiscated parts of a military rocket-propelled grenade launcher Monday at a Pennsylvania airport. The disassembled parts of the launcher were found in a man's bag at Lehigh Valley International Airport, the TSA said in a press release. Public affairs spokesperson Lisa Farbstein shared a photo of the assembled weapon, noting that it was not functional.
Well, if it's not functional, then is it still...
When assembled, the launcher was determined to be a non-functioning, and the grenade an inert replica. Thank goodness. I'm looking at it here. Imagine that going through. All right, what's this?
No, that would kind of, you know, freak you out.
Yes.
That has to be a first for a lot of those TSA employees there at that checkpoint. If not a first for most TSA employees.
The press release of the man from Florida was detained by police for questioning. The man told authorities he thought he was allowed to bring the military-grade rocket-propelled grenade launcher and replica grenade into the onto the flight in his checked bag. The items were confiscated, and the man was allowed to complete his flight.
Okay. Now, it from the other side of it, really? Okay. Forget what you think might be allowed, because
right,
we'll just say, all right, we can chalk that up to pure ignorance. You don't fly much. I've got disassembled RPG.
Wolverines!
And a replica. But did you really think about it going, gee, I wonder what this replica grenade will look like in the screening process, as the very capable TSA agent is looking, and, you know, because they'll stop. You ever watch the one that's looking at the screen?
Uh-huh.
I always watch them because it's always fascinating to me. And they'll be like, I had a bag of coins in my, no, it wasn't coming back from Vegas. It actually was because my work bag, my backpack, you know, is my work bag. And I had a bunch of coins for the vending machine, and plus, if I get off early enough, I go to the casinos. But anyway, I had this bag of coins, and they were looking at the bag of coins. We just got to look at it because, you know, you can't see through the coins. We just need to look at the bag of coins. And I was like, oh. It's always a fascinating process, unless I'm in a hurry. But imagine you're sitting there in that position, and you're looking at that screen, you know, because you'll look down. They look down, and all of a sudden, the belt rolls backward about, you know, an inch or two. That looks like a grenade. It's a replica. It's designed to look like a grenade. You thought that was allowed. You thought it was okay. You thought it was a good idea. Now, I don't know what you're doing. Let's just say it's part of your job. I don't know what that would be, but it's part of your job, right? If it were me, I'd show up to the airport like 10 hours early. I would check it, and I would tell the agent or the person at the airline's desk when I check the bag, hey, I just need to let you know there's something in my bag. I know it's safe. It's a toy, but it's part of, you know, I don't know, I'm an international security expert or something. You know, just giving every benefit of the doubt. But you think it's okay.
Right.
To do that.
I'm letting you know before
I even get to the line? Is there a TSA person I can talk to? I have this thing that I wish to bring. You actually call them.
Yes.
And let them know that you're going to be there, right. That I have this replica thing.
Can I meet with an agent or a group of agents ahead of time, you know, to give you guys – because if you insist on having that in your carry-on for whatever reason, there are two ways, right? You leave it in the bag and wait for the inevitable, or you take it out of your bag – and wait for the inevitable, because in your bag, only the TSA agent is going to be the first to notice it. If you take it out along with your laptop and you put a replica grenade there in the bin with your laptop, everybody behind you is freaking out.
Oh.
I know I'm backing up at least 2 feet.
Well, mine was the best. I was back for the holidays one time, and a friend of mine, her daughter had a fundraiser for the holidays, and it was, you know, you got a candle. Mm-hmm. And she said, I said, no, you keep the candle. No, you take it. We want you to have it. It's small. You can bring it back with you. So it was thin and maybe about 5 or 6 inches long, but a nice little candle in a glass case. I said, okay, I can throw it in my bag. So what I did was, this goes back over a decade ago. Remember the old cigarette lighter chargers but they had the coiled wire. Remember it was very mm-hmm, coiled?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this was a thin thing, so I wrapped the coil around.
Oh, that was a good idea.
This candle, not even thinking, put it into my bag. I said, sir, we really need to check. All of a sudden, there's all these agents around the bag.
Right.
And they open it up. They look in, and it's. And I said, what are you looking for? They said, a bomb. I said, what do you mean a bomb? They said, when you wrap something like this with the coil and a candle, it looks like a bomb.
Right.
Like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
I'm amazed they didn't have me down, because they actually showed it to me the way that it looked.
Right.
You know, on under the X-ray.
Right. Because
they had another X-ray machine. They showed it to me, and I went, and you have it. I thought I'd be up against the wall, you know, guns pointed at my head and everything else. I'm like, well, you guys are pretty calm. And they go, well, it sort of looked like it, but we figured we've done enough with the coil, you know, with the coil things where people wrap it around different stuff. So, no, we weren't really panicking.
Well, but in this case, if I'm the agent and I'm looking at, well, what looks like the outline, it's going to look like a grenade.
Yeah. Yes.
My heart's racing at that point because, you know, you're wondering.
Yeah, somebody trying to blow up TSA security.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Because you would have, I mean, we have to think about all the different scenarios or what the bad guys might want to do. And they're going to try and inflict the most harm on the most people in one setting. And that would freak me out. I mean, how do you not think of that? The night before, the guy's packing his bag. Okay, got my disassembled RPG launcher, got my replica grenade. Should I take two? Should I take two replica grenades? It's a short trip. Just one.
But all the bottles are just 3 ounces of liquid.
That's right.
In the sealed plastic bag.
Right. I mean, I don't know. Seriously. Even if you think it's allowed, is it a good idea?
Let's head to you on a number of topics we brought up today, including socialism. We go to Daniel in Texas. Daniel, hi. You're on Red Eye Radio. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hey, guys. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I was you had a previous caller that he was kind of off. You know, you were kind of trying to explain Switzerland, and he brought up Germany. And I'd heard on a news show, I'm sorry I don't remember specifically, but they were talking Finland and saying that the GDP that they spend on their military is almost nothing. And we know that most of the European countries, because they depend on NATO, which the United States covers a lot of, they really have, on a percentage-wise, a lot more that they're investing in, even in the socialist, you know, that they can invest in socialist activities. But the United States, with such a larger budget, I think a lot of people just don't consider that. Even with that much money, they're still, you know, that they have more than what the United States has because of our military budget. They're still.
Yeah, but socialism, you know, doesn't work anyway.
Yeah, I mean. Yeah,
it still doesn't work. Military spending or not, it doesn't work.
Because what you're talking about essentially is the idea of a smaller, much smaller number of people paying the freight for the larger group. And it actually, when you look at the United States, we've heard that argument before, Daniel, and thank you for the call. We've heard the argument by people on the left before, oh, no, it'll work because we're the U.S. and we're bigger and we can absorb that. No, the left wants you to believe, I mean, those on Capitol Hill and in positions of power want you to believe that we can do that better, that we have greater wealth. We do have greater wealth. We still don't, but the equation doesn't change. You're talking about a smaller group of individuals paying for the masses. On how many levels have we, I mean, look at now, because now you're talking about basic income. Now you're talking about Medicare for all, free college. That would be a massive, 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 massive amount of money. And we don't have that wealth. We don't.
Let's go to Tom in Port Angeles, Washington. Tom, hi. You're on Rudder Radio. Welcome. Hi, Tom.
Hi, gentlemen. Say, I'm just, you know, curious. I always try to call with original thought, and I see the left that wants to, you know, talk about your U.S. carbon fiber footprint or, you know, whatever it is, all this green stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And at the same time, they're trying to get as many people in here as they can. Whether it's legal immigration or illegal immigration, they're bringing them in from everywhere else, which bumps up the population, which is more carbon consumption. Mm-hmm. And I'm confused by that.
No, that's a great point. Gary's made that point before. I think especially when it came to the Green New Deal and Ocasio-Cortez, and Gary made that point. Because
right. I mean, I'm sure they would say, look, those people still exist around the world, so they add to the carbon footprint to begin with. But if you're talking about your own country, right. And that's what you're trying to get down
trying to control.
But I love how you call it the carbon fiber footprint. That was that
thanks,
was my
Tom.
Favorite part of it, though.
Well, and that's right. It. And if you look about the government, you know, what we should do as a nation, if they're to come here and be a part of this nation, then the other, you know, because the other day, Ocasio-Cortez says, well, we need to actually ask the question, should we have children? Well, you're part of the same group that's saying you can't separate illegal
yes.
immigrants from their children at the border, that you can't, that they should come here and we should welcome the children. Look, we know that's the hypocrisy is everywhere when it comes from the left and when it comes to the left and their ideas that they're promoting. No, the math never adds up. It's always the fuzzy liberal math that goes nowhere.
Well, that's why they went to net carbon zero instead
exactly.
of, you know,
exactly.
zero carbon.
Right.
Net
zero.
Zero.
Mm-hmm.
Net means fudgy math.
Yes.
866-90-RED-EYE.
When your batteries talk, it's important that you listen. To avoid getting stuck out in the cold this winter, be aware of these two warning signs that may indicate your truck batteries are trying to tell you something. The most obvious sign is your truck's inability to crank at the proper speed. If you experience any sluggishness, it's likely an indicator that you have a cranking problem that may be battery related. Another warning sign is wet or damp batteries. This may indicate your batteries are leaking or overcharging and will eventually fail. Being aware of these simple warning signs could help you escape the cold this winter and help avoid future repairs. If you're experiencing sluggish cranking or notice your batteries are moist, stop into a TA truck service to have your cranking system and batteries tested and inspected by a trained technician.
This maintenance tip is a service of TA Truck Service Road Squad. If you break down, we show up. Call 800-924-SHOP.
Coming up, more with Gary McNamara and Eric Harley. It's Red Eye Radio.
It's Red Eye Radio. He is Eric Hurley, and I'm Gary McNamara. Let's go to Joey in East Lansing, Michigan. Joey, hi. You're on Red Eye Radio. Hi, Joey. Welcome to the show.
A few questions. So if we write Johnny a blank check for tuition for 4 years, which bureau is Bernie Sanders going to designate to ensure that that degree is going to lead to a return on investment in a career. And what if little Johnny, after 2 years, has a good degree like accounting and is failing and decides to go into interpretive dance and delay the degree by 4 more years, turning 4 years into 6 years?
Yep.
And will the price be the same for Michigan State University or Harvard or Lansing Community College? Just some questions.
All great questions.
So you're asking us questions that we can't answer.
Yeah. No. Well, but making solid points along the way.
Yeah.
And this is it. All of those ideas that have as they rail against the banks. How dare you lend to a student and then not guarantee that they're going to be successful? And that's it. Because that's the idea where the jealousy and envy is built is in those ideas, those original ideas as they're presented. And they're very easily, as you just did, they're very easily dismissed when you start playing out the scenario under, Bernie's plan or anybody else that starts talking about free college. Because, and then when you get beyond all of it, it's, imagine that they say, okay, starting, 2021, everyone gets free tuition. All those that graduated in 2020 are looking back going, I'm sorry, what? All of those who worked their way through college and paid as they went, they're saying, wait a minute, I was working and combined with my school, it was 20 hours a day or whatever it was. I mean, 15, 17, 18 hours a day even. And now you're going to give this handout. Are you going to give me a tax credit? Everybody's going to want theirs. But then when we get beyond all of that, when you start talking about a free education, tell me what the value in the workforce would be for that education. If everybody were to get it, how many people would it have the same value in the marketplace? I'm not saying that there isn't a college bubble, just like Mark Cuban pointed out, but we actually have to talk about what the marketplace puts in terms of the value on a college education. And another great question. Okay, what if it's an Ivy League school? Well, wow. You got an Ivy League education, so your benefit would be huge. Or are we doing away with the Ivy League educations and everything's going to be like a public school? Everything's going to be a, you know, this standard and that standard. And there won't be these types of colleges that stand out and above all the others.
Well, I think the only way that you really appreciate an education, which means is you look at it in a completely different way, is when you pay for it. If you don't pay for your education, you don't look at it the same way.
Right.
Because when you pay for it, you look for a return on your investment.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You do.
You look to take right. that and use it, especially I think right. with an education. You know, with my kids, it was, you know, first like our generation, but with my kids as they got old enough to have a car, teaching them if you're paying for that vehicle, you're going to take better care of it. You're going to know what it takes to pay for a vehicle, all the hard work that goes into it, and maintain that vehicle. You're going to want to preserve it. But with an education, you're talking about something you're going to, I mean, the idea is to take that with you for a lifetime, that education, and then use that, apply it accordingly, all of your adult life. That is something you're going to be considering.
But if I'm still paying for an education and I wish to take something that I know isn't going to get me a job, mm-hmm. well, then I'm doing it for that particular reason. I don't expect a return on investment because I've done research because I'm paying for it. So right. if I wish to take courses that will help get me a job, then I do so. Mm-hmm. If I wish not to, then I understand that the money that I'm paying for it is to accomplish something else in my life.
Mm-hmm. That's but the premise of choosing whatever study that you're going to get engaged with.
Right, but when there's the difference, whether you agree with free college or not, there is a difference on how human beings react.
Mm-hmm.
When you pay for it, you react in a completely different way than if you don't pay for it.
Exposing BS Nightly. Eric Harley and Gary McNamara on Red Eye Radio.
It's Red Eye Radio. He is Eric Harley and I'm Gary McNamara. 866-90. Red Eye still chuckling from the last caller. I just...
Here's some questions,
and none of the questions could we possibly answer.
Right. Yeah. Well, and it is a, you know, those rhetorical questions point out something, a number of things that are very, the very clear flaws when all you have to do is stop and think about how this would work. In the case of Bernie and his plan for a free college for everyone, well, A, they won't. They're not going to be able to afford for everyone. So then it's going to get down to some get it, some don't. Oh, now you've divided people.
Well, everything's going to be means tested eventually.
Yes.
You can't pay.
And how
can't
do you
pay
do that?
For all. By the way,
it's
healthcare.
Not based on the student. It's
right.
Based on the family.
Medicare for all will be means tested,
right.
Which means you're going to have to pay. There are people that are going to get it for free, and then there are people that will have to pay for it, depending on your income, mm-hmm. because they can't afford to just do it one way. And that's why we brought up Sweden, earlier in the show, and talked about, and over the last week or so, John Stossel's documentary on Sweden, because that's the excuse they always give on the left. Well, we need to have the socialism like Sweden has, and that's why he broke it down and said, look, Sweden, the middle class, pay a ton of taxes more. They don't tax the rich like they do in the United States,
right.
Because they understand in order to provide, not for the socialist state, but for the welfare, a more welfare state. Actually, the economy is more free than the United States there. They need a ton of free enterprise to support a more welfare state, even though in some cases it's not more of a welfare state because their pension system is actually a private system, which depends on you yourself putting in. But what they mentioned was the middle class taxes a lot higher than in the United States, because when you want that consistent flow of tax dollars, you can't depend. You see New York right now panicking because the salt tax is affecting the top incomes there, and they can't have that. We've talked about that before, that when you take, what is it, New York, what is it, like 40-something percent is paid by the top 1%? And when you have that, when you have a downturn, there's a massive reduction in tax receipts to the Treasury. When you're a socialist nation, or more of a socialist nation, or more of a welfare state nation, you need to tax the middle class in order to get there. And we've talked about this. That's the big lie. The big lie is tax the billionaires and we can pay for everybody else. That isn't the case. It's never been the case.
Nope. No.
Let's head to you. We go to Richard in Virginia. Richard, hi. You're on Red Eye Radio. Welcome to the show. Hi, Richard.
Hey, guys, great show, as always. You get me through the shift at night.
Thanks.
The issue is with these socialists, liberals, progressives, whatever label we want to put on them, they are counting on the economic illiteracy, the economic ignorance at present and to continue to be able to pitch these wish lists, free for everything, free for me, and, you know, it's like y'all say, you know, people just want it free. They don't want to have to pay for it.
Right.
Well,
right.
Somebody's got to pay for it.
Yeah.
Who's going to pay for it?
Hmm.
The productive people, the people who are working.
Yep.
And, you know, why can't we this? Why can't we that? Well, why can't you get out of my pocket and go to work and get it yourself?
Well, and that's it. I mean, because when you start nurturing that state, yep. I mean, it was Daniel Patrick Moynihan, a Democrat, that coined the phrase the pathology of dependency years ago. But as you get closer to that state of more and more gimmies, there's less of an incentive to go out and earn. Then you have more people dependent on the government, and that grows. You're basically rewarding for nothing, for less.
Well, and it's just like the point y'all made with the education system. You know, if it's going to be for free, it's going to be devalued. Okay. Well, who gets it? Who doesn't? You're
right.
And in Germany, as I understand it, well, the way they do it is you're means tested and you're steered towards what your testing determines you're going to be proficient at. Well, your testing tells me I'm going to be proficient to be a mechanic. I don't want to be a mechanic. I want to be a doctor. Y'all are withholding my innate. Y'all are denying me, depriving me of my inalienable right to choose what I want to do. Then you start getting into the caste system like they have in India. Once you're a shoemaker, you know, your daddy's a shoemaker, your granddaddy was a shoemaker, you're going to be a shoemaker.
Right.
That's totally counterintuitive to everything we do in America.
Well, and, right. and that's the whole point when we talk about the fact that I don't believe we live in a country that wants socialism or a free stuffer country, because as soon as you start,
exactly.
but as soon as you start giving free stuff, even free college education, you see what happens in these societies where they say, okay, well, we just can't give it to everybody. You need to means test it
mm-hmm.
somehow. Now we have to see what the value of it is. We've got, because there is no value to an education, because you can take whatever you want and the government will pay for it.
Thanks, Richard.
Well, it's not productive, but then we need to start steering people towards what will actually be productive for our country, which takes away your choice. So you say we get a free education, but it's not what you wish to do.
Right. I mean, if you look at the way that with the John Stossel documentary, the idea of nurturing capitalism and free markets, free enterprise, in order to support a welfare, the welfare state. But what you're also doing in turn is that you're promoting less of a welfare state in terms of the number of people that would be reliant on the government. Because if you're promoting free enterprise, if you're promoting people going out and you're nurturing that as in terms of policy, then there is a great benefit to the masses when there is that expansion of wealth, whether it's innovation or whatever it might be. When that expansion of wealth happens, it lifts everyone, which means that those on the lowest end of that income scale also benefit, bringing more people out of that welfare state.
Look, the problem has always been the fact that we have become a country that has accepted debt.
Mm-hmm.
That you think about that. That's
yeah.
the whole problem has come
right.
from that, because what we have figured out, once we figured out that we could find a way to tax people without representation, and we've successfully figured out a way to have taxation without representation. What do? We borrow money that has to be paid back generations later, which means we put the burden on future generations, and they're not born yet, so they can't be represented. They don't have a say. That debt is on them whether they like it or not. We found that loophole, and we just don't think about it, because when you think about it, every one of you right now, when you think about it, you say, that's pretty immoral thing to do. It really, really is when you think about it. We're getting what we want today. Now, if you're saying we're doing it because of war, the nation's survival, you can make that case.
Mm-hmm.
But even in a war, you can pay that within a generation.
Right.
But what the kind of debt that we have now for what we want now, and that's what it's about. It's about what we want now. The debt is not because we have a strong military. The debt is because of what the public wants now
mm-hmm.
and what the public wants in a federal government. And because we have the ability to tax without representation future generations and commit that immorality, it's the only reason that we're in the fiscal situation that we're in and will be in the future when it comes to how in the world do we pay off this debt. We have put the burden and then the devastation that will come with it on people that have no say in it whatsoever.
When we had John Taffer on years ago,
From Bar Rescue,
you may have seen it. It's on Paramount. Used to be Spike TV, but it's on Paramount. And when they get into their, you know, they have a like a marathon on Sunday. I'm like scolding out loud Taffer. I'm like, Taffer, I need to be doing show prep. But actually, some of it is show prep in that, because when we had him on, I said, okay, what do you think? There was a bar owner that had, what was it, $900,000, $1 million in debt.
Something like that.
And I can't imagine that kind of individual debt, right? And I said, you know, do you think it's generational? Do you think that these individuals just look at those numbers on the paper and they don't really put a value to it? Because clearly they didn't care about that debt. I mean, what do you think is behind that? And he said, yeah, I mean, it is. They're just looking at this as almost like this two-dimensional thing, just a set of numbers, just a ledger. And it's not really mine. Somebody else will take care of it. And that's when you talk about the national debt on such a massive, massive level, when we've stopped caring about it and our audience notwithstanding, then it becomes, then you have to think about the mentality of what is it that we, that, why is it? As you mentioned, war, that's one thing. But
that's survival of
right,
the nation.
But, right. But it has been, it has been much more than that. It is, you know, yeah, when you yeah. when you have people that represent you well, and if you don't care, they're not going to care, and we've talked about that, that are willing to go out and spend other people's money all day long, every day, and we're looking at $22 trillion in debt and growing. Where does it end? Because what changes that mentality? The only thing that changes that is a catastrophic event economically. And that is going to see entire programs go away. Forget about the haircut. Remember years ago we were talking about, they were talking about the idea, okay, if you cut, you know, the penny plan, all right, you just cut 1% or whatever. Or you just don't increase, right? A zero out. We're nowhere even close to that. When you talk about a catastrophic event,
no.
Entire programs would go away.
And now we're building up massive deficits and massive debt in good times. Right. Not in bad times has right. been, you know, traditional. Well, things are bad, we need to have infrastructure. In the good times with good economic growth, we are just skyrocketing the debt, and that was with Republicans in power. Imagine Democrats in power, that as we see now, and they're not shy about it at all. Forget about it. They can't even look at it anymore. They started saying, well, the Republicans are spending too much. Well, now with Ocasio-Cortez and where they're headed, $51 trillion, $91 trillion. I mean, they're talking 100 times, 200 times the spending that we have right now. It's like it doesn't even matter.
No.
We're to that point where, look, the money doesn't even matter. Just go with it. We don't even care about what it is. We'll just figure out a way somewhere down the line to do it. Absolute irresponsibility. But again, you get absolute irresponsibility when you start out being a little irresponsible.
Right.
And then a little bit more irresponsible. And what do you get to? You get to the point now where it's absolute.
Well, and you, yeah, because you touched the flame. Well, that didn't burn.
Yep.
And now we've got both hands over a flame and believe it's not going
to
burn.
It's horrible that we've got to this point. Not unexpected.
And by the way, we haven't introduced the idea and possibility of going to war on a massive scale with one or more sovereign nations.
Yeah.
And what that would take.
866-90-RED-EYE.
Lines open for your calls. 866-90-RED-EYE on Red Eye Radio.
It's Red Eye Radio. He is Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. So, yeah, some interesting calls here on socialism, as we always get. It's a great topic to talk about because, you know, I think it's important for people to start discussing what type of society we wish to live in. You know, overall,
right.
What kind of society and, you know, what works and what doesn't work. And so bringing up the whole capitalist versus socialist argument is always one of my favorites because it does get into talking about economics and how economics really works and getting to actually talking the reality of economics versus talking points. You know, as we talked about earlier, earlier the caller that we got that was just a liberal talking point. Billionaires should pay more. Buffett paid less in taxes than his rate. In taxes than his secretary.
Look at Germany.
Now that the argument for Sweden is gone after John Stossel's documentary, Germany then. Let's find another country here.
Yeah.
Let's keep searching. It's got to work somewhere because a problem with socialism is the right people haven't got a hold of it to do the right thing with it.
Right. We'll do it better. Certainly we'll do it better.
If we can get the central bureaucrats to just do it right, if we can get the Borg collective in the big box, the big Borg box,
where there's a consensus of minds to control the money. We can do it.
As one caller phrased it, I think he coined the phrase galactic communism. There will be no money. The food will just magically appear out of the replicator. Problem with the replicator, it gives you the same thing every day.
Well, we actually did get, we did get to that discussion, didn't we? That whole yeah. Star Trek thing.
Well,
the,
I mean...
Well, there is no money anymore because there is no... You know, shut up. There'll always be money in human society.
Yes.
Always.
Right. It is a symbol of your work.
It may be digital.
Yes.
It may be in the John Wick coin.
Oh, man, but John Wick 3 is on the way. Did you see the trailers?
Yeah. By the way, what's that coin worth on John Wick?
I don't know.
I know.
We need to look
that
up.
What is the value of that coin?
I don't think they've said.
No, they haven't.
This is Red Eye Radio on Westwood One. Now, it's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or you're just starting your day, welcome to the show. This is Red Eye Radio.
All across America, 866-90-RED-EYE. He's Eric Harley and I'm Gary McNamara. Welcome and good morning. In the news today, and this should get some play over the next couple of days. At least on conservative media. I don't know if the left wishes to touch it, but the record immigration surge at the border, the new numbers coming out, arrests of families crossing into the U.S. illegally in the past 5 months hit a record, prompting the chief of Customs and Border Protection to say the system is at the breaking point. That's from the Wall Street Journal. Hmm. From October and through February, border agents arrested 136,000 people traveling in families for crossing the border illegally. The prior record for a 12-month period was 107,000 during the fiscal year that ended in September, and that's just October through February, beat what it was for the past full year. More than 64,000 people were arrested in February, making it the busiest month since President Trump took office and the busiest February since 2008. You and I talked about this, that the numbers coming out like that yesterday and showing what the pattern is over for the last 5 months could be just what the president needs when it goes before a federal judge, the national emergency order.
Yeah.
That he can say, wait a minute, as you can see here, we have talked about it being a national emergency over the last few months because we've been looking at the numbers. Whatever, he can make this point hypothetically. We've been looking at the numbers weekly that have been coming in because that's what we've been hearing from the Department of Homeland Security. That's what we've been hearing from ICE and Customs Enforcement. All along, they've been telling us, look, there's an increase going on, and that's what I've been telling the American people. And you can actually use that as a legal point to justify maybe not portions of where your national emergency goes, but the first step, which is to say, okay, a judge will say, I'll look at this, and yeah, it's legit. It's a national emergency. There has been an increase in there, and the president, look, it's a gray area that Congress put in there, and I see it. Yeah, go ahead. Now, you may put your money in areas where you can't do it, or you may try to confiscate private property if you're not going to use eminent domain to accelerate the building of the wall, which could cause legal problems down the line.
Mm-hmm.
But you and I had a great discussion earlier about, look, there's a possibility you can separate what you'd actually do in a national emergency from getting approved by the federal courts a national emergency.
Yeah, because if you look at this, then you can add to those numbers. You can say, along with these numbers here over the last few months, we can add at least two caravans which were clearly organized, and you can then display to the court, show them a reasonable, I think within reason, a situation that is clearly escalating in this time frame, because it really is about the timing. But I guess the you could split hairs and say, well, we're at the point of reaching the proverbial camel's back and the straw, but you don't even have to go there when in terms of what could be declared as a national emergency situation. These numbers here, along with the fact that you've had at least two organized caravans, and the administration believes that it is within their power to declare a national emergency. We could see the courts looking at that saying, okay, that's great. We're not going to get into the business on the judicial branch. We're not going to get into the business of deciding or, I guess, measuring what is and what isn't a national emergency. But you've made a good case for it, and we're not going to deny that. What they could deny, however, is what they do about it. And really, that comes down to eminent domain, because the administration, if they are cleared to use this as a national emergency and the declaration goes through, then they get $2.5 billion. They can get that from other budgets because the military would be involved in that area of building that wall. We're not talking about a 2,000-mile wall any longer. We're not talking about something on a grand scale. And we're talking about one measure in a series of tools or new policies within that department of controlling the border. And I could see the court separating it, saying, okay, if the eminent domain cases get to the highest court, we'll deal with them and at that time. And that's going to be separate from whether or not we decide what is and what isn't a declaration of emergency or what rises to a national emergency. So I think one thing, too, is that, you know, you look at it and say, okay, we have the system set up where they can come in with a resolution, which they've done in the House, and the Senate is going to vote on it. And so we have the makeup. We have the ability within the system. It doesn't matter politically what the makeup is in either the Senate or the House, but we have the system set up where the people can have their say through their representatives and say, no, we don't want you declaring a national emergency for this purpose. And that would require, in this case, a veto-proof majority. And that if it doesn't rise to that, then that is still the system at mm-hmm. work.
New name surfacing from the Republican Senate side as possible defectors now. Mm. Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, Mitt Romney, Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, Moran of Kansas. New names that have surfaced. They believe the defection could be as high as 15 senators if they have the vote. Reading this from thehill.com. Two of McConnell's top advisors are scouring the Senate's rules and procedures to figure out whether it's possible to vote at an alternative to the Democratic-sponsored resolution of disapproval. Republican senators say, this is from The Hill, say they want to vote for a resolution that states the president should have sufficient funds for border security, but they also want to express disapproval of the emergency declaration and amend the National Emergencies Act to require future emergency declarations to expire after a period of time unless Congress votes to approve them. I believe we should come up with the resolution or a piece of legislation that would express exactly how we feel, which is we support the president. We do need better barriers, said Johnson, the chairman of the Senate Homeland Security Committee, after a meeting of the GOP conference on Tuesday. At the same time as members of Congress, we should jealously guard our constitutional authority, which has been given away by prior Congresses. So there you go. Senator Pat Toomey is leading one promising effort within the GOP conference to put together a resolution that would express support for Trump having adequate funding for border security while also disapproving of his emergency declaration and possibly limiting future executive seizures of spending power. So there you go. And as I said, though, you know, you can look at it from the way we would as a judge and the way a judge would look at it. I can also understand conservative senators saying, we don't want to give up our authority. This is our authority. Mm. We're a separate branch from the executive branch. There is the constitutional issue here. So, like I said, every time we talk about it, I'm like, are we getting too complicated? It's like, well, no, that's what it's all about.
Well,
it's very tough to simplify it any further than I think that we have tried to
right.
by looking at all the different sides. How you look at it as a federal judge, constitutionally, how you would look at it, and the gray area that I believe does exist in all of this, constitutionally speaking. And also, let everybody know that I believe there's an emergency at the border, but it doesn't matter what I think. It's what is a constitutional emergency declaration, What specifically is it? What is the law that Congress passed in 1976? How does it apply to this? What is possible precedent that exists on it? It's not what you personally think. If you go to social media, you see this from a lot of Trump supporters. Well, of course it's a national emergency. Everybody knows it is. That actually means nothing for the discussion of the legalities of it. Because I believe it's a national emergency. What's going on down there is unacceptable. You cannot have that going in. It's been a national emergency for a long time. Is it by the rules that have been set by Congress a national emergency, and you get three or four different opinions on that? Maybe even more. You get the yes or no, but you get the yes but, or you get the no but, which is why you can get three or four different definitions of what's going on and concerns that people have.
Yeah, and I would say here, if there is a veto-proof majority, then you are keeping that within.
Yes, you
that
are.
That is the legislative branch saying, no, we're taking that power back. You know, and they talk about, you know, the appropriations of funds, and certainly on that point, yes.
Well,
the question is, does it allow the president, and this could well end up in the courts. Does it allow the president or any president, any administration, the executive branch, to use unlimited funds and pull in great amount of funds? In this case, it is limited.
Yes.
It's very limited. And I think that's where the difference would be, because they talk about implementing and changing the law here to say that the declaration of emergency would expire at whatever point, and they threw up, you know, whether it's 30, 60, or 90 days, unless Congress votes to approve it. Then you have to consider a situation like we're in now, where you had a number of lawmakers on the left that just a few years ago were supporting this exact scenario.
Mm-hmm.
They had no problem with the offense or barrier or whatever you want to say, and no problem with enforcing the border. And that's changed drastically. So I understand the constitutional issues with these conservatives, including Ted Cruz, but is that not already accounted for in the ability for Congress, with a veto-proof majority, to take that away from
the president? Not from their point of view, because their point of view is defending their branch, and they don't believe that the national emergency ever was intended to give the president this kind of authority outside of what they view as an acute situation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
I know how they think, but this is me arguing with them, because they can get the veto-proof majority.
Well, that's, I'd argue it from a federal judge side. Well, that's your veto-proof majority, but they're looking at it from individual members of Congress.
Oh, sure.
And how they interpret the gray area of the National Emergency Act. As I said, this is an area where you can look at it, you go, I can understand that, I can understand that, I can understand that, I can understand that. But as a judge, I'd rule this way. And that's why it gets to be so complicated, because as a judge, I would rule and say, look, even if I think that the new numbers do make a difference, because Trump can make the case now that, look, this thing is accelerating to the point where it's never been before. And a judge would look at it and say, all right, even though I think the National Emergency Act was never meant for this, that's what I think, but there's a gray area in here. I'm not really sure. Congress wasn't specific on it. And therefore, since they weren't, I, as a judge, am not going to set the limitations on what a national emergency is of executive power. You guys hash this out and you go over it. And you sort of did, because you do have the veto-proof thing in there, where if you can override it, so it's not all of Congress that wishes to override it, or that majority that was set up within the system, therefore what the president wants goes. I can see that happening, even if I understand Rand Paul and Ted Cruz, and I may be taking it too far out of line as to what they think, because I'm extrapolating out what I believe they probably think, And I can say, I still think that they're right, but as a federal judge, I would rule this way. I would rule the way he's saying the president could do it, even if I understand the point that they're saying, no, it was meant to be this way and the president is going too far on it. I can understand where they're coming from completely. I can actually agree with them and as a federal judge still make the decision that the president is right. Mm-hmm. I hope that makes sense.
Well, again, you know, because and for me, we have if you got to a veto proof majority, if let's say they went through the Senate and the bills started changing and then they had to send it back over to the House and they got a veto proof majority on both sides, it would be a non-issue. That is Congress essentially retaining its power.
All right. I can understand what Cruz, I'll simplify it. I can understand what Cruz and Rand Paul, I can understand their point of view. And I can view that, and they say it's right. And I can agree with them. And I could also be the federal judge not saying Trump is right, mm-hmm. but saying Trump can do this because the system's set up to do it this way. There's a gray area, and I'm not going to make the decision as a federal judge. Mm-hmm. Because that's not my say as a federal judge.
If the president doesn't build a consensus on Capitol Hill, right? Imagine that he went to Capitol Hill and he campaigned in trying to build a consensus to say this needs to get done. I mean, forget that it's Trump, any president. And he wasn't able to do that. And then Congress came back and they said, we disagree with you. And then they can build a consensus within the Senate, including people like, which is kind of what's going on in the Senate right now. Let's build this consensus that we don't want, we consider this overreach, or for whatever reason, we don't believe that this rises to a national emergency. For all the reasons, we need to build that consensus and build a veto-proof majority. The system allows for all of it.
Oh, I agree with it. That's how I'd rule as a federal judge. Mm-hmm. But what they're saying is, we believe the law prevents the president from doing this, mm-hmm. that the law itself should stand,
mm-hmm.
that the law itself is above a veto-proof majority because it's the law and we want the judge to rule in that way because that's the law that Congress passed and the law is what Congress passes, not how the president or the courts interpret it,
mm-hmm.
or not how the president interprets it, the court can interpret it in their favor, and they would be for that, of course.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not a simple issue.
No, not at all.
No.
And again, I think, again, with any executive action, and I guess it depends on the details of any given executive action.
Yes.
You have the ability of Congress to go back and reverse it.
I personally think there's a huge gray area in there, though. That's where I would probably disagree with them. It isn't specified in the act.
Right. That they would have to point
yes.
to me where that,
right.
where, what part of that law are you talking right. about, referring to?
866-90-RED-EYE.
Spring doesn't officially start until March 20th. Keep that in mind as you hear USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey discuss bitter cold covering the country this past weekend and early this week.
We saw some all-time record low temperatures for the month of March being set.
Across the nation from Washington State to Nebraska. And while the cold has lost some of its power moving into the south and east, Rippey says there is still
enough of a cold air surge in the deep south to threaten blooming fruit trees as well as recently planted and emerged spring sown crops.
For instance, blueberries, with development pushed by warmer weather, are now threatened by sub-freezing temperatures through Wednesday across the southeast.
The only areas escaping Tuesday morning across the western central Gulf Coast states, deep south Texas, a few counties there in the lower valley, and also southeastern Louisiana managing to escape.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The USDA report is sponsored by Cenex Roadmaster XL Premium Highway Diesel Fuel and Shell Rotella.
We'll be right back with more Red Eye Radio with Eric Harley and Gary McNamara.
Most of the moisture today will be falling west of the Mississippi. For California, we have more coastal rain in store, with rain in the lower elevations and snow in the mountains. East of the Mississippi, look for dry conditions, with the exception of some lake effect snow in and around Detroit and upstate New York. As some of that energy from the west continues eastward, by tomorrow night, we'll start to see some snowfall, mainly along I-80, Lincoln, Nebraska, into Des Moines, Iowa, and portions of I-35 and I-29. Continued cold in the south, with another overnight low in the 20s for Atlanta. That's after today's high of 46. In New Orleans, this Ash Wednesday will be down into the 30s, but not quite the freezing mark. Later today, warming up to near 55. Sunday's Alabama tornado ruled an EF4, 170-mile-an-hour winds. Your national forecast from Red Eye Radio, I'm meteorologist John Trout.
Patriarchy, oppression, and injustice. Red Eye Radio.
Yeah, but you didn't finish. What does that mean? He's Eric Hurley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 86690 Red Eye. He just stated it.
It's
Gary McNamara.
North Korea is restoring a rocket launch site it had dismantled as part of its disarmament pledge last year. Just a week after the nuclear summit between Kim Jong-un and President Donald Trump ended without an agreement, this from Fox News. Report said yesterday, new satellite images show that efforts to rebuild some structures at the Tongchang-ri launch site started between February 16th and March 2nd. The Associated Press reported, citing 38 North, which is a website specializing in North Korean studies. The structures being restored included a rail-mounted transfer building, for which new walls have been erected and a new roof added. 38 North reported the engine support structure at the engine test stand is also being reassembled. The report said new roofs have been installed on the fuel and oxidizer buildings. There was a lot was made of that missile site last year. It will be interesting to see how the White House responds. They have not yet responded to this story. It'll be interesting to see how they respond today and where the president goes on this. No surprise at all, by the way.
No.
This is not
a surprise
at all.
No. Nope. There's nothing changed about it. If you look at the tactic, what the U.S. has been trying to accomplish with North Korea since Trump has been president, really is all about the process. First of all, likely an educational process for the U.S. when you look at the fact that Mike Pompeo, even before he became Secretary of State, sat down face-to-face with Kim Jong-un. And that is, of course, a fact-finding mission, not that he's going to learn anything, but you learn about the individual. He's not going to learn about necessarily the stockpile of weapons, but do we need Kim Jong-un to tell us what those weapons are and give us a complete list in terms of inventory? We just need to assume that it is a very large and growing inventory, and I'm sure that is the case with the U.S. And then vetting the process out. I mean, walking through this to make sure that if it ever gets to a point where a preemptive strike is necessary, that the U.S. has done its job in terms of diplomacy. And so far, they're well on their way. And is it going to mean he's going to disarm? Nope. It's going to mean that we show the world that we were able to go to the table with Kim Jong-un, an unprecedented move, go through all of that, have at least two summits now, and he's still not complying. And again, in the event that a preemptive strike is necessary, I think on the world stage, there can be no question that
we
took every measure.
Well, the world realizes then, or I'm sure the world actually realized, but you have shown the world again, you've communicated the message that they do not wish to denuclearize, that their whole goal stated last year that they wish to denuclearize was not true.
Right.
And we knew it wasn't true. But the fact is you at that point can say we've jumped through all the hoops.
Yeah.
And we've said this a long time ago. We never expected it to happen. We have always wondered when the president starts talking about, as he did even recently as a week ago, about what a great potential they have economically. They could be an economic power. They don't want to be an economic power. Kim Jong-un doesn't want to be an economic power in the Western style. He'd be there would be a coup. He'd be out of power. He'd be executed.
Mm-hmm.
That's the last thing he wants. He wants an economy just good enough where he can retain power. So whether the president's using that type of language as a bargaining chip or as a part of negotiation, he would have to explain to me how that's actually working. Because
or is it a
I've never got it.
Is it a tactic to where you can again show our allies in the event that we have to go to war with North Korea or
you,
take action?
You did you the say, best possible.
We say, look, we gave them every option. We showed them, especially when in going to Hanoi. This is what a growing economy can be. This is how your country can benefit from this.
I, as president of the United States, we were excited about the economic power that they could be.
Yes.
Yeah. You throw
right.
You throw what you actually know is not true to the world to help make your point.
Well, I mean, but you've, again, well, given you, them, we gave them every
well,
option.
You show what your motivation was.
Yes.
Our motivation was to make them a great economic power. That was our goal. I stated it many times.
Mm-hmm. And that's
okay.
it.
I'll give you that.
We gave them every single option to not go this direction, and they did it anyway.
Right. So, Mr. President, if you're listening this time, if that wasn't where you were going, now you know you can go there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
Advocating. Oh, by the way, this next article comes from a publication that is not a conservative financial publication.
All right.
Not necessarily a conservative financial publication. And the person interviewed, not necessarily a conservative economist, Republican, from CNBC, advocating that the government print money without worrying about paying the bills to guarantee jobs for everyone, Medicare for all, or the Green New Deal is a dangerous approach being pushed by far-left Democrats. Former Barack Obama economic advisor Larry Summers told CNBC on Tuesday, "I do not think that this is a realistic calculus," said Summers, blasting the idea of modern monetary theory backed by self-described Democratic socialists, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Bernie Sanders, who last month announced another run for the White House. The modern monetary theory, which really should be the modern money tree theory, should it not?
Yeah, right.
Where we can guarantee jobs for everyone or have Medicare for all and just rely on money printing to finance it, I think that's a quite dangerous approach, Summers said in a Squawk on the Street interview. Countries all over South America have tried it with disastrous results, said Summers, who also was Treasury Secretary during Bill Clinton's presidency.
Hmm.
He argued that the MMT-like policies were tried and reversed in the early 1980s in France and the late 1990s in Germany. Summers pointed out that he's been arguing for most of the last decade for more fiscal stimulus to boost economic growth, but that's not the same thing as saying we can rely on money finance for everything. So what he's saying is, even though we want some debt, these people are nuts. Even though we're Democrats and want lots of debt to boost economic output, which is fake GDP, by the way. Mm. The majority of it's fake GDP. It's not the same as the private sector doing it. But what they're saying is, look, we're really liberal. These people are liberal nuts.
Right.
That's actually what he's saying.
Right. Well, because when you look at QE 1, 2, 3 through 9, however far we went with that, you look at that kind of policy and what did it really do? Was that really encouraging the kind of borrowing by businesses by shoving a bunch of money into the bank, saying we're going to make it easy for you to borrow money. Did that really spur that the kind of growth that they promoted?
No. All the economic stimulus was over the 8 years of Obama, and right. we never once got over 3% growth.
Right.
Ever.
Right.
For 8 years in a row.
Well, what you saw was, and who said it in the talked about the article, and somebody wrote about it, saying it was really essentially the largest bailout for Wall Street, because when you talked about the interest rates, you know, dropping the interest rates dramatically, and then it shoved a lot of money, of course, to what? The stock market. You had a lot of people getting involved that otherwise wouldn't have. And so you had a huge bailout for Wall Street. But it didn't mean economic growth. And I'm not a populist. What happens on Wall Street, you know, is gonna happen. But the government tries to tell you that it is going to equal or lead to true economic growth. And that simply wasn't the case and won't be the case going forward.
But at least he did not refer to Ocasio-Cortez as a pompous little... Oh, I'm sorry. Yesterday's story.
Yeah.
And, I just... This is the last story for the day, and all I can say is, wow.
Hmm.
I don't even know where to go with it.
Okay.
But it's from CBS San Francisco. The median one-bedroom rent in San Francisco. What do you think it is?
One-bedroom
rent in San Francisco.
$1 million.
Close. Depends on how long you want to stay. By the way,
hold on. I'm trying to think. What would a 30-year mortgage be on a $1 million home?
Yeah, right. Wait a minute.
I'm trying to think.
Are you better off buying it? Yeah.
On a 30-year mortgage for a $1 million home.
Yeah. Well, you're looking at what? Yeah. $10,000 a month.
Maybe $10,000 a month. Okay.
Probably.
It'd be more. All right.
Eight or nine.
Median one-bedroom rent in San Francisco, $3,700 a month.
Now, what's interesting here is that I met a young lady one time. I was traveling to California, and she lived in a house in San Francisco with seven other people. It was a four-bedroom house. You rented half a bedroom. And at that time, it was $2,000 a month. You're bunking. You have a. I was going to say cellmate. Sorry, it's not prison. They're all there voluntarily. As far as I know, they're not being punished for anything. But you share a room with somebody else, and that was $2,000. So, and by the way, that's median, which means. Half of them are less than that. $3,700 for one bedroom. So I'm wondering how many scenarios there are. I mean, you know, for like an apartment, or are you talking about just renting, like she was doing, one room, one bedroom, and you all share the kitchen. I can't even possibly fathom that. Which, by the way, shows you why. That's one reason why California is number one when it comes to poverty, because years ago the Census Bureau had to start calculating the cost of living as opposed to the cost of living as opposed to the average income in that state, and you have higher poverty there in California because of this, because the cost of living is so astronomical.
But that's why, if and it depends where you are in the country, you say, well, how could, there's no way that anybody could claim that if you make $120,000 a year that you're just middle class. Yeah, you can.
Yeah, yeah. Depends on where you live, but
depends on
certainly
yeah, depends
plenty
on
plenty of areas.
Depends on where you live and what the cost of living is.
Right.
Because remember, that's just a one bedroom apartment.
Mm-hmm. We're assuming apartment. Or right. Were they renting, or some of those people renting one bedroom, like the young lady I met? I'm assuming they're saying apartment, yeah.
Right. Two bedroom was almost $4,700 a month.
Nope. No. I mean, you know, when they, remember when Bay Area Rapid Transit, BART, was on strike, and they were saying, this was several years ago, and they were saying, look, the cost of living, and we,
Erica,
in order for us to work here, we have to live close.
Wait a minute, a two-bedroom apartment is over $55,000 a year, just in rent.
You're not even talking about groceries and everything else, which is also astronomical.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
866-90-RED-EYE.
What's the difference between standard number 2 diesel and premium fuel? Ron Jessen is Director of Product Management for Cenex, the makers of Cenex Roadmaster XL Premium Diesel Fuel, and he fills us in.
You may want to consider the total operational cost behind the price of the pump. If you look at the cost for replacement and you look at the cost of ongoing maintenance, unfortunately, those costs haven't gone down. They've actually continued to increase. But switching to a premium diesel fuel can really result in some large operational savings with the fuel economy and reducing the equipment repair costs. Our fleet owners, if you want to consider trying a premium diesel fuel in the past, or if you have considered it in the past, now is really the time to take advantage of that with the lower diesel fuel prices to try out that premium diesel fuel.
There are more than 1,450 Cenex locations in 19 states across the Midwest and Pacific Northwest. Visit Cenex.com to find a Cenex location and learn more. This report is a service of Shell Rotella.
Get in touch with Red Eye Radio, toll free at 866-90-RED-EYE.
It's Red Eye Radio. I'm Gary McNamara. He's Eric Harley. So Bloomberg says no. Bloomberg says no. He's not going to run, which means our soft drinks are safe.
Yeah, no soda cup size ban.
Nationwide, yes.
Yeah.
This is Red Eye Radio on Westwood One.